You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Part 3. After having helped Connie pack her bags and sending her and Gordita on their way with the warmest of goodbyes he could manage, Jim and Rhea teleported to the Embarcadero. The street, which ran along all the piers of San Francisco Harbor from Fisherman's Wharf and under the Oakland Bridge to Oracle Park, lay bathed in warm sunlight when they materialized close to the ferry terminal. Jim had, wise from experience, emptied his stomach in the toilet before they left and didn't produce more than a dry heave when Rhea teleported him. It always made him sick to his stomach to move like this, but right now, it was necessary. They appeared in a corner close to the water, out of the way from prying eyes. Jim had been holding Rhea's hand during the teleport and didn't let go when they materialized, something she didn't seem to mind. They began walking along the Embarcadero back toward the wharf, while looking up at the hill that rose to their left.
"How come the vampire didn't give you the specific address?" Rhea asked.
"I don't know. Maybe he didn't know it. Maybe he just didn't feel like helping me quite that much. I do have somewhat of a reputation with the vampires."
"As what? The cranky immortal?"
"Not exactly. More like an executioner."
Jim had put on sunglasses, but now took them off and looked Rhea in the eyes.
"I've done some things I'm proud of in my life, and some I'm not. To be honest, taking out a couple of rogue vampires are in the first category. That's how I got on the prince's good side, and it helped keep the city safe. I had sort of hoped this would be something similar, and that I would have his resources to back me up, but no such luck if the Elysium is shut down."
"We'll make it work. I'll back you up."
Rhea smiled.
"You won't even miss the vampires. I promise."
"It's not me I'm worried about. It's the cops and civilians that might get caught in the crossfire. The vampires were always handy to make sure streets were blocked off or people guided away from the fight."
"It sounds like they were pretty big fights," Rhea said.
"Some of them were."
Jim cleared his throat.
"Okay, look up there, at the top of the hill. That's Coit Tower. The house was supposed to be below it."
Jim took a small pair of binoculars from his jacket pocket and looked through them.
"I can see three different houses up there. Here, take a look."
He passed the binoculars to Rhea, who scanned the hillside.
"Uh-huh. Three houses. But I'm betting it's the one on the right."
"What makes you say that?"
Rhea kept the binoculars to her eyes as she spoke.
"The first one is all square and boring looking. That's not a house for a vampire prince. It lacks class. The second one is too small and further down the slope. The one on the right looks elegant, and it's right at the top of the hill, giving it the best view. If you were the prince, would you want some mortal living higher up than you?"
"Good point. You're probably right, although Lamort isn't that hung up on the whole them and us thing. He came into power because he believed mortals were just as worthy as vampires. Although, when you go by how gleefully the vampires seem to have been about going back to hunting, I wonder if his rules really were what the other vampires wanted."
"Didn't you say he'd been in power since the 1970s? He must be doing something right, or they'd have overthrown him a long time ago."
"Maybe so. He's a sensible person, at least, even though he's too high and mighty for my taste. Okay, if we're betting the house on the right is his house, can you get us up there unnoticed?"
"You mean, can I get us up to the house?" "Yes. Can I get us inside?" "A bit more difficult since I haven't been there before and all the curtains are closed, which makes sense if vampires don't like the sun. Do you think Maurice has Lamort's house guarded?"
"Almost certainly."
Then, if I were Maurice, I'd put a guard somewhere outside the house, either in the grounds or, more likely, just outside the gates in a car. Vampires can't really turn into bats, can they?
Not that I've ever seen them do.
If they can't, they're probably not worried about people flying in. A visitor would come through the gate or up to the house through the garden. They won't expect someone like me. Not that most people ever do. I'll try to get us inside. But you realize that there's a chance we might materialize inside a table or a bookshelf.
Has that ever happened to you?
Jim looked uncomfortable. No, because I try to only jump to places I've seen. But are you willing to risk it?
Yes, I trust you.
Rhea squeezed Jim's hand. I know you do. She leaned in and kissed his cheek.
Come on, let's go over there.
They were standing almost in front of the ferry to Alcatraz, and next to the ticket booth stood a giant model of the Alcatraz prison as it had looked when it was in use. Rhea pulled Jim behind the model, where there were fewer people. She pushed her hair out of her eyes and took both his hands.
Okay, now hug me tight.
Jim hugged her.
Is this to make us take up less space or something?
Yes, and to get a hug. She grinned and nibbled on his ear.
Okay, hold on, here we go.
Rhea concentrated, closed her eyes, and with a popping sound, they vanished, and reappeared in a living room, where the heavy drapes kept every bit of sunlight out. The room was decorated in a style that Jim instantly felt at home in, heavy leather furniture and wooden bookshelves. A large TV screen took up most of one wall, and the other walls were hung with paintings of San Francisco landmarks.
This is actually quite nice, Jim said, as Rhea let go of him and looked around.
Her old thief instincts kicking in, she tried to listen to the noises of the house. I hear people in the next room, she said in a low voice. Two voices, I think.
Jim nodded. I hear them too. Let's go find out if it's the prince or not.
They both put their ears to the door and could hear the voices clearer.
So incredibly disturbing to work with,
a female voice said.
He is intelligent, certainly, but he also practically worships de Lavigne. Everything I've proposed, he's vetoed. It seems like their plan is to have no rules at all.
Jim's brow furrowed. He recognized the voice from long ago.
I realize that, and I understand your feelings.
Another voice, which Jim also recognized, answered. He had heard this voice only a few days ago.
But it's vital that you stay strong, Alani. I need you there, helping to uphold my policies. Just like he can veto our suggestions, you can veto his.
But he doesn't make any. None at all. Like I said, what they seem to want is nothing at all governing them. A prince in name only, but in reality, anarchy.
Rhea looked at him.
Sounds like we picked the right house, wouldn't you say?
She still kept her voice low.
Yes, although I wished he'd been alone. Okay, come on, but be ready to use your defenses in case they jump you, like you did with Feline when we met.
Don't worry, they won't get near me.
Jim raised his hand and knocked on the door, two quick knocks, before opening it.
Prince Lamort, we beg an emergency audience, he said quickly.
The room they entered was made in two levels, with a lowered part in the floor at the end of the room. Here stood a piano, in a place that, when you pulled away the drapes, would command an unimpeded view of the bay and the embarcadero below. Next to the piano was a couch, shaped like a half circle, so an audience could watch the piano player. The walls were hung with original artwork, and in various spots stood small sculptures on shelves or pedestals, carefully lit with tiny spotlights. In the other end of the room stood a large dining table with 10 chairs, placed under an impressive-looking chandelier. It was at this table that the two people they had heard speaking sat. Rhea took a closer look at them as they both rose from their seat and stared at them in surprise. The man had a sharp-featured face, was wearing a very well-tailored black suit, and looked to be in his early 20s. With his black, slicked-back hair, he was only a black cape short of looking like a movie vampire. Rhea felt a strange sensation in her stomach as she looked at him. In a way, he was one of the most handsome men she'd ever seen, but she couldn't say exactly what it was that made him attractive. Indeed, the pale skin and the slicked-back hair alone might have been enough to disqualify him in her normal taste in men, but something about him made her stomach flutter a little, and she felt slightly embarrassed about it. The other person was a beautiful Asian-looking woman dressed in a red and gold dress. Both of them looked a lot different from the vampires she had seen in Convergence Club while she lived there. Those had looked more or less like humans with fangs. These two were different.
"Jim,"
the woman said, surprised, but the prince smiled in what looked like relief.
"Mr. Corrigan, how in the world did you get in here? Although I suppose if anyone could." "Courtesy of my friend here. She's good at getting in and out of tight situations. We didn't feel it was a good idea to walk up to your front door in case you were under guard."
"A wise precaution.
I am indeed being watched. My opponent has, as you suspected, put guards on my front door. Human guards, as well as undead ones, so there is no advantage in coming here in the daytime. I can leave freely, of course. I'm not imprisoned, but I can go nowhere without being followed, and I don't enjoy hurting my own subjects if I wanted to leave undetected. He wants to keep tabs on me. Make sure if I do anything to hurt him or his compatriots, he will know about it."
The prince sighed and gestured to the woman.
"But where are my manners? This is my advisor, Alania Coney, and you are?"
"Rhea Weston," Rhea said.
"Miss Weston, I am charmed to make your acquaintance,"
the prince said, inclining his head in respect.
"Hello, Alani,"
Jim said, a bit hesitantly.
"It's been a while,"
Alani said, a smile making her mouth widen just enough to show her fangs. The prince looked from Alani to Jim, and then smiled, slapping his forehead.
"Oh, of course! How could I forget? The Avenue Killer. You two worked together. Some very intense nights, if I remember correctly. I was most appreciative of your help back then and how well you worked together."
Jim blushed, and Rhea noticed it. She looked at the woman, who had sat back down again. The beautiful face, the long hair, the dark eyes, and the dime dropped.
"Oh my God, you dated her, didn't you?"
she said, looking at Jim. She smiled a wicked smile.
"I'm actually meeting your ex?"
"No. Well, it was just one date, and it was more of a work date. We were hunting a vampire. Things happened. It was a very intense chase, and we got carried away."
Jim looked uncomfortable, and Alani seemed to sense that he felt bad. She made an apologetic gesture to Rhea.
"I assure you, I have no interest in him today," she said.
"Look, this was back in 1979. You weren't even born then,"
Jim said, looking more uncomfortable than ever.
"Right."
Rhea couldn't help but laugh.
"I'm sorry. With a guy as old as you, I should expect there to be an ex or two hanging around the city somewhere."
"Can we get back to the matter at hand, please?"
Jim said, and walked forward, sitting down at the table across from the prince. Rhea sat next to him, while Alani kept her place at the head of the table.
"I agree," Alani said. "We should keep this business only, Jim. We can catch up some other time."
There was an audible sigh of relief from Jim.
"I second the regent's opinion," the prince said, sitting back down. "I assume you've got a reason to beg an audience with me?"
Jim put his hands on the table.
Of course we did. I'm not in the habit of doing social calls by teleportation. I've come to understand that you've been dethroned, that the truce has been broken, which would have been nice to know, by the way, and that the Elysium has been shut down. Finally, from what I heard before we knocked, someone else is running the city now, someone who's not a prince.
You are correct. I do apologize for not informing you of the truce being called off, but my means of contacting you have been somewhat limited. As for rulers, Alani has been appointed to govern as one of two representatives. The other is Maurice's right-hand man, Diego Alonso.
Maurice, Jim said. That name was in the paper as well. Is he the one who wants to be the new prince?
He is, although from what I understand, Alani said, with a hint of contempt in her voice. He's not really interested in ruling, as much as giving everyone free rein to do whatever they want. A kind of vampire free-for-all society, as if we went back to the Stone Age.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Jim leaned forward and looked at the two vampires.
All right, Prince, or ex-prince, or whatever. Can you tell us everything you know about this Maurice guy? Who he is, what he's been doing, why he's doing it. Anything useful?
The prince rubbed his chin.
You're asking a lot, but I believe it will benefit us to work together, as it has before, and I had anticipated we would get together sooner or later. I will share the information I found with you. Alani, the folder, please.
Alani got up from the table, left the room for a moment, and came back with a brown folder, which she handed to Lamort. He opened it, flipping through it.
As far as my informants have been able to discover, Maurice de Lavigne, which is his real name, was born in 1839 in France. He comes from a small city in Bordeaux, where his parents owned a vineyard.
The prince looked at Rhea.
Lavigne means from the vineyard, my dear, in case you don't speak French.
I don't, so thank you for the language lesson, Rhea said, with a smile that didn't look very real, and a little bit of the fluttery feeling in her stomach went away. She had never liked men who acted superior to her.
1839, Jim said, his mouth open in surprise. I've never met a vampire that old. I never thought.
No, they are quite rare. Older vampires tend to die out, when the world changes so much that they can't keep up. I myself was born in 1947, so he's far older than me. Apparently, he was from a rather small family, and he was allowed to travel to Paris to educate himself in the arts. Music, literature, sculpting, painting. He was very, very talented, and made his mark on Parisian society.
Lamort turned a leaf in the folder, showing them a photograph of a painting depicting a young blonde man resting in a field of flowers.
We managed to find this. It's a self-portrait of him.
Jim looked at the painting. The young man looked relaxed, and almost beautiful in a feminine sort of way, with his long hair and slender physique. He was holding one flower up to his nose, smelling it, and smiling a dreamy smile.
Well, it's not my style, but I guess the guy could paint.
He was one of the most promising young artists of his time, almost a prodigy, Alani said. He lived in Paris for years, where he studied under several great masters. One of them, unfortunately, decided to turn him immortal.
You mean the master was a vampire? Rhea said.
Alani gestured around the living room, as if taking in all the various paintings and sculptures decorating it.
Many great artists have been vampires, Miss Weston. Only we have the time and skill to truly create eternal beauty.
That's a little pretentious, Jim said.
But with basis in fact, Lamort said. But that is neither here nor there. As Alani said, his master decided to turn him immortal, which happened sometime around 1859, as far as we have been able to piece together.
How do you know?
Because that's when Maurice decided to use quite a different canvas for his art, Lamort said, with sadness in his voice. I don't know what happened to him during the turning, if it just brought out a darker side in him, or if he was always like this and merely managed to conceal his true nature, but when he became a vampire, he began to murder people as an art form. The prince turned several pages in the folder. My agents have followed his tracks all over the world for the next century or more. He traveled around, sometimes alone, but sometimes with an entourage of other vampires, settling in places and spreading local fear. Sometimes he would create a kind of patsy if the authorities began getting too close to him. Several famous serial killers have been set up by him. The kind of people, I bet, where you could never picture them doing the things they were accused of, Jim said. Not exclusively, no. Sometimes Maurice would inspire, I suppose is the best word for it, someone, giving them a little of his own artistic sense, trick them into doing murders in his style. As far as I could discern, people like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ed Gein, Victor Bertrand, Peter Curtin, and perhaps even Jack the Ripper himself, were creations of Maurice.
How? Rhea asked, her eyes wide. How would he turn someone normal into a killer?
The gift of immortality is different for all of us, Alani explained. Some vampires can do things others can't. Some can control animals. Others can turn into animals. And others can turn practically invisible because they force you to look at a place where they're not.
So, the whole turn into bats thing wasn't as far off as I thought, Jim said to Rhea.
Maurice's special gift, the prince continued, is that he can induce feelings and emotions in others and share his own with them as well. He can, in a sense, get inside your head and make you do things you wouldn't normally do or force you to feel something he wanted you to feel. Rhea looked at the prince and again felt that flutter in her stomach, which she usually associated with men she wanted to sleep with. She wondered if that was his power, the ability to attract people to him. It would make sense if you were a ruler that wanted to ingratiate yourself with your subjects.
So if Maurice tells me to be afraid, I will be afraid, Jim said.
Exactly. We have witnesses from the diner, as well as the playground yesterday, who have heard him do just that. He speaks a word and makes you feel that emotion. Fear, anger, sorrow, despair.
What about love? Jim asked. Can he make people love him as well? That would make it easy for him to take over the city.
Love is a complex emotion, Alani said. I'm sure he could make someone feel desire or lust, but actual love? Probably not instantly. But given time, maybe.
Jim put his hand in his pocket, pulled out his cigarettes, and put one in his mouth. He looked around for an ashtray, found none, and decided to just keep it in his mouth unlit.
So how do you protect yourself from that sort of thing? Rhea said.
The prince shrugged.
You don't? Humans don't have the mental discipline for it, although I don't know if it would work on you, Mr. Corrigan, since you're unique. Your immortality protects you from most of the vampire threats, so I would imagine that might help you keep your mind your own as well. But anyone else, you wouldn't have any way. Although, apparently, some people have more resistance than others. My agents were unable to discern a pattern for that, though.
Rhea and Jim looked at each other for a moment. They both thought the same thing. If Maurice found out about her abilities, he would be able to turn her into a powerful weapon.
Maurice traveled all over the world, Lamort continued. We have reports of him everywhere, from London to Tokyo, from Cape Town to Lofoten. He even spent some time in the U.S. before, mostly in the Midwest and on the East Coast in the 1930s. Everywhere,
he managed to spread blood and chaos. But everywhere, he managed to escape without creating a lot of problems for himself. Most of the time, he would do just one or two murders, then move on before he was suspected.
Smart guy, Jim said. But in the last few years, Maurice has been working his way across Asia and Europe, going west. This is also where he apparently picked up, or sired, we're not quite sure, his two companions, Diego Alonso and Ernst Schulten, from Spain and Germany, respectively. Here are pictures of them all from the Elysium's cameras. Lamorte handed them all a couple of glossy photos, showing the three men from various angles. Diego, who now sits as co-regent with Alani, was a quite prolific artist and businessman who had traveled all over the world before and after his turning. But Ernst appears to have stayed in and around Hamburg, not making much fuss for himself.
Why would these guys follow Maurice? Jim said. He doesn't seem to be the most stable of employers.
Probably a mixture of curiosity, fascination, and greed, with a healthy dose of admiration thrown in, Alani said. Diego is a smart man. He wouldn't follow Maurice if he wasn't looking to gain something from it. Perhaps Maurice actually plans to make him prince when he himself tires of the job. Ernst, I believe, is more of a lapdog. And, of course, they are all lovers.
It seems to be the time for people around me to come out of the closet these days, Jim said, but waved his hand impatiently. Okay, sexual preferences aside, go on.
Lamorte continued. For the last 7 months, they've been here in the United States, apparently keeping a marginally low profile until very recently. We have had a couple of reports of Maurice in Arizona and the Midwest, and now he's here.
All right, so that's his backstory, and I know what he and his buddies look like. What are his weaknesses?
Jim said. The same as any other vampire you've ever faced. Fire, decapitation, dismemberment, and blood deprivation. However, Maurice is most unlikely to suffer from the latter.
Yeah, sounds like he drinks whenever he wants.
Jim rolled the cigarette back and forth in his mouth.
So, we have to burn him or cut him up?
There is no we in this, Jim, Alani said. The prince can't be involved in the fight against his opponent, and as regent, neither can I.
So you're saying you want us to do your dirty work for you? Rhea said, sounding more upset than she thought she would. You're just going to sit back and watch while this guy kills people, or until we kill him?
I'm bound by the laws I myself helped set up in this city, Lamorte said, and his voice had a tone of regret in it. Believe me, there's nothing I want more than to face him man to man. But that's not allowed. The election has to take place, and from the stories I hear about my subjects relishing the chance to hunt again, I'm afraid he might actually win, and the city will suffer for it. However, if you do my dirty work, as you call it, he might not live to be elected, and I would, hopefully, be able to return us to the status quo.
Jim sighed.
Of course we'll do what we can to take the guy out. He's dangerous, and obviously hell-bent on wrecking the city I've spent the better part of 40 years protecting. It would just be nice if we could actually count on some backup from you and your people.
What you can count on, Alani said, is information. Anything I can tell you from my time as regent, I will pass on to you. If my co-regent does or says anything useful, I will tell you at once.
Such as where Maurice is hiding out, for instance?
He doesn't seem to have a hiding place as such. My guess is that he moves around between several places. The only one I know of for sure is the Hotel Kabuki, where Ernst has been seen multiple times, and Diego mentioned going there the other day.
Alani shrugged.
But I don't know if he moves every night, every other night. He's a ghost. None of my, well, our, men has been able to find him. He just pops up.
All right. Whenever you know something, get in touch. Here's my number.
Jim gave both of them his business card.
The prince looked at it and gave a nod as if pleased with something.
Ah, you have a cell phone now. About time.
Are you quite sure there's no way I can block him out of my head? Rhea asked Alani and Lamort.
If I can, there's a good chance I can help you stop him. But if he gets in my head, things could get very bad.
The two vampires exchanged a look.
I will look into it, Lamort said. It would require some rather impressive mental discipline.
Oh, trust me. I know all about controlling my mind and my own dark sides, Rhea said dryly.
Interesting.
The prince looked at her, and Rhea again felt the magnetism of the man, now directed specifically at her.
Hey! Hey!
Jim said, waving his hand in front of the prince's eyes.
Eyes off the merchandise. Just find out if it's possible.
Lamort smiled, despite his grave demeanor.
Jealous, Mr. Corrigan?
Let's just say I don't approve of unfair competition.
Very well.
Lamort got up from the table, scooted the folder over to Jim's side, and Jim picked it up.
I will have Alani contact you. If you need to speak to me, call her, and we will arrange a time for you to come here. As impressive as your powers are, I wouldn't want you to appear here in the middle of something you shouldn't witness.
He shook Jim's hand, in a grip that, to Rhea, looked like they were both trying to squeeze the other's fingers.
I'm glad you came, Mr. Corrigan.
Jim,
I've counted on you before, and I hope this will be no different.
He took Rhea's hand, kissed it, and looked her in the eyes.
Au revoir, Miss Weston. It was a pleasure.
Okay, enough of this crap,
Jim said, taking Rhea's hand out of the prince's grasp and holding it tight.
Let's go home.
Rhea concentrated, and they vanished.